Reading again from Coincidence or Conspiracy, Charles Colson has disclosed that he and his law partner, David Shapiro, tried on behalf of President Nixon to recruit former Warren Commission General Counsel J. Lee Rankin, R-A-N-K-I-N, to serve as the first Watergate special prosecutor. Colson's disclosure that he and Shapiro tried to arrange the appointment of Rankin as a special prosecutor in March of 1973, days after James McCord broke open the Watergate cover-up, came before the House Judiciary Committee on Impeachment on July 15th, 1974. So the first choice, according to Colson, by the Nixon administration for Watergate special prosecutor was J. Lee Rankin, general counsel to the Warren Commission. Skipping down now in the account here of Rankin. In 1976, the National Archives disclosed that two letters written to Warren Commission General Counsel Rankin were missing from the National Archives collection. A, quote, letter of David Bellin to J. Lee Rankin, January 23, 1964, on interrogation of Oswald by Dallas Police Department, unquote, and also a, quote, memorandum of Griffin to Rankin in August of 1964, dealing with a number of inquiries to be made of various agencies, one of which had to do with unidentified prints found on the cartons in the Texas School Book Depository. Two interesting pieces of information, two letters, one letter and one memorandum missing from the National Archives, both involving J. Lee Rankin. Now, this is a pattern that we're going to see repeated over and over as we take a look at the various participants from the Warren Commission and various aspects of the supposed investigation conducted by the Warren Commission into the Kennedy assassination, and many of these same people involved in one way or another, or potentially involved with the Watergate scandal. Note how many letters and memoranda involving some of the people that were tabbed by Nixon to act in one way or another in connection with the Watergate scandal. Take a look at how many of them have either letters or memoranda missing from the National Archives. More about J. Lee Rankin and Watergate. President Nixon and close confidant Charles Colson attempted to retain J. Lee Rankin in October of 1973 to serve as a, quote, neutral party, unquote, in evaluating which of the secret Nixon Watergate tapes would be turned over to special prosecutor Archibald Cox, and on which should be held, withheld, on national security grounds. J. Lee Rankin had served as general counsel to the Warren Commission and thus held the single highest ranking position on the commission staff. Rankin supervised the entire investigation and had served as the Warren Commission liaison to both the CIA and FBI. It was Rankin who was the target of heavy internal commission dissent for his decision to end any further investigation into the crucial single bullet theory at a time when other staff counsel were convinced that the theory was impossible. And after J. Lee Rankin was not selected as Watergate special prosecutor, and he did not apparently function as sort of a special intermediary to review the Watergate tapes and to decide which information was too sensitive to be disclosed on the grounds of national security, the next choice by the Nixon White House was John J. McCloy, a key Warren Commission member. Reading again from Coincidence or Conspiracy, in early 1976, former Attorney General Elliot Richardson revealed that President Nixon had suggested on April 29, 1973, that Richardson appoint John J. McCloy as special prosecutor for Watergate. John McCloy, as previously noted, had served as one of the actual members of the Warren Commission. Along with former CIA Director Alan Dulles and Congressman Gerald R. Ford, McCloy had been a leading proponent of the controversial single bullet theory of a lone assassin. McCloy still remains an ardent defender of the Warren Commission findings, claiming that no evidence of a conspiracy was ever found. So after first trying to tab J. Lee Rankin, and then trying to requisition Rankin to review the Watergate tapes and decide which tapes could be withheld on the grounds of national security, Nixon goes for John J. McCloy. Bear in mind again that Archibald Cox was President Kennedy's Solicitor General. He was Solicitor General of the United States under John Kennedy. Finally, Archibald Cox was removed in the so-called Saturday Night Massacre and replaced by Warren Commission Counsel Leon Jaworski, who also sat on the board of directors of the M.D. Anderson Fund, a CIA domestic funding conduit. In coincidence or conspiracy, there's another interesting piece of information concerning Leon Jaworski presented by Bernard Fensterwald and Company. Well, it's interesting. Now, by the way, I would add that many people, myself included, suspect that Fensterwald himself may very well have been CIA. Not only was he selected by a former CIA operative, James McCord, to represent him, usually veteran intelligencers select counsel from the intelligence community, but there are key omissions in Fensterwald's book. It's a very good book and contains much vital information, a must for any serious researcher, but there are also very, very serious omissions. And Jaworski, or Fensterwald, I should say, does not mention that Jaworski was on the board of directors of the MD Anderson Fund. He does add the following piece of information, however. In 1976, the National Archives disclosed that two of his, that's Jaworski's, letters to the Warren Commission were missing from the records of the commission, including a, quote, letter of December 18, 1963, unquote, expressing a continuing, quote, willingness to assist in any way, unquote, as well as a letter of Leon Jaworski to J. Lee Rankin, May 8, 1964. And it should also be noted that, as we noted in the Guns of November Part 3, Jaworski also served as special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, the Texas state body investigating the Kennedy assassination, on behalf of then-Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr. It's also worth noting that one of Jaworski's assignments was to find out whether Lee Harvey Oswald had been an agent of either the FBI or CIA. And again, note that two of his letters were also missing from the National Archives. That is a pattern that we will see repeated over and over. We alluded to the preposterous single bullet theory a few minutes ago. That was developed by Warren Commission counsel Arlen Specter. He also figures in the Watergate situation as follows, reading again from Coincidence or Conspiracy. In early December 1973, President Nixon reportedly asked former Philadelphia District Attorney Arlen Specter to become the head of his Watergate legal defense team. The Philadelphia Bulletin reported that Specter had met with Alexander Haig to discuss the defense position and had also discussed the increasing likelihood of an impeachment investigation. Specter subsequently turned down President Nixon's request for legal assistance, and James St. Clair, a former lawyer for Charles Colson, was chosen for the position instead. So it's interesting that Nixon's first choice to head up his legal defense was Arlen Specter, the author of the single bullet theory. Specter, of course, turned it down. Yet another Warren Commission counsel who figures in the defense of Nixon and company was Albert Jenner. Reading again from Coincidence or Conspiracy. In early January of 1974, President Nixon approved the selection of Albert Jenner to serve as the GOP's minority counsel for the impeachment investigation of the House Judiciary Committee. Jenner was to have served as Nixon's chief legal counsel on the committee, but later abandoned that role after the massive evidence of impeachable offenses began to mount against the president. Albert Jenner had been a senior counsel to the Warren Commission and had been in charge of investigating Area 3, Oswald's background, history, acquaintances, and motives. Jenner is credited with having been one of the key authors of the final report. So, Albert Jenner was at least approved initially as the GOP minority counsel. He later bailed when the evidence became, when the massive evidence grew that, in fact, Richard Nixon had been guilty of impeachable offenses. Many of the people involved in the Watergate scandal selected Warren Commission counsels or people involved with the Warren Commission to represent them in connection with Watergate. One of those was John Dean. Fensterwald writes, John Dean selected as his defense attorney another man intimately familiar with the assassination of President Kennedy. In April of 1973, Dean retained Charles Schaefer, S-H-A-F-F-E-R, shortly before he went to the federal prosecutors and turned state's evidence against the Nixon circle. Charles Schaefer had served as administrative aide to the Warren Commission, and unlike other top commission aides, had been recommended for the position by Robert Kennedy. During the course of the Watergate investigation, Dean reportedly felt that his life was in danger at various times, which led to his eventual protection by U.S. Marshals. Woodward and Bernstein have written that Woodward learned from Deep Throat on May 16, 1973, that Nixon had threatened Dean personally at one point, warning him not to reveal certain secret matters that Nixon claimed were, quote, national security, unquote. Dean has publicly stated, as late as last year, that there were still, quote, very big, unquote, revelations yet to emerge from the Watergate mystery. One wonders whether his retaining of Charles Schaefer, an administrative aide to the Warren Commission, may have had something to do with that. John Ehrlichman, a key Nixon aide, retained Joseph Ball as his defense attorney. Joseph Ball, also a Warren Commission counsel. Returning to coincidence or conspiracy, in April of 1973, John Ehrlichman also selected as his first defense attorney another man connected to the Warren Commission, Joseph A. Ball. That's just like in a baseball, the last name. Ehrlichman was then facing initial charges relating to his key role in the Ellsberg burglary. Ehrlichman was then facing initial charges relating to his key role in the Ellsberg burglary. Joseph A. Ball had served as senior counsel to the Warren Commission and had been in charge of Area 2 of the Commission's investigation, the identity of the assassin. In his recent novel, The Company, Ehrlichman has written about a president and a CIA director who were blackmailing each other over a past assassination plot that had involved CIA elements. Some observers have speculated that the Ehrlichman novel may actually be referring in some way to the Kennedy assassination. Ehrlichman refuses comment on this. The conversation, as related by Haldeman, between himself and President Nixon suggests at least that possibility, that maybe Nixon and Helms were blackmailing each other over the involvement of Nixon and elements of CIA in Kennedy's assassination. Continuing here with Fensterwald's account of Joseph Ball's representing John Ehrlichman. In 1976, the National Archives informed the House Subcommittee on Government Information that two documents of Joseph Ball were missing from the Warren Commission records stored at the archives. Quote, memorandum 60 pages of Ball and Bellin concerning identity of the assassin, unquote, and a, quote, draft chapter submitted by Ball and Bellin in early June of 1964, unquote. By the way, Bellin, B-E-L-I-N, is David Bellin, a Warren Commission counsel and consistent defender of the Warren Commission. Again, note the pattern of missing documents, or documents that had been authored or co-authored by many of the people involved in the Warren Commission's alleged investigation and the Watergate scandal. Note that so many of these documents were missing, for one reason or another, from the National Archives. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Gerald Ford was named. He was a key Warren Commission counsel. He was named to be vice president by Richard Nixon when Spiro Agnew was forced to resign. We're going to see that same pattern of missing documents connected with Gerald Ford. Fensterwald writes, on October 12, 1973, President Richard Nixon nominated Congressman Gerald R. Ford to succeed Spiro T. Agnew as vice president. Gerald Ford had served in the House for over 20 years and had been a member of the Warren Commission. Ford became the most active member of the commission and went on to become the most vocal defender of its conclusions. In 1965, he wrote a book, Portrait of the Assassin, which set forth his belief that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone, deranged assassin inspired by communist beliefs. In 1976, the National Archives disclosed that a, quote, letter of Gerald Ford, April 7, 1964, concerning expediting the FBI investigation, unquote, was among the Warren Commission documents missing from the Archives building in Washington. Again, the pattern of missing documents. Now, earlier, I alluded to the famous 18-and-a-half-minute gap on one of the Watergate tapes. The official explanation provided by Richard Nixon's longtime secretary, Rosemary Woods, was that she had kept her foot on the record pedal while she turned around to do something else, thereby accidentally erasing the tape. And again, Gordon Novell, initially recruited by Charles Colson to study the feasibility of using a degaussing gun to erase some of the Watergate tapes, he and Colson claimed that he never actually followed through. But Gordon Novell maintains that he was the one member of the panel of electronics experts which reviewed the 18-and-a-half-minute gap, and he was the one member that said that it could have been accidental. All the others said it has to have been deliberate. Rosemary Woods also retained as her defense counsel someone who was connected with the Warren Commission's investigation, or really alleged investigation. President Nixon's longtime personal secretary, Rosemary Woods, was advised by Nixon to retain an attorney to defend her against possible charges growing out of the mysterious 18-minute tape erasure on the Nixon-Haldeman June 20th, 1972 Watergate tape. Woods had become a prime suspect in the tape erasing probe. On November 22, 1973, Miss Woods selected as her attorney a man who had also worked closely with the Warren Commission investigation, Charles Rhine, spelled R-H-Y-N-E. Rhine, a personal friend of Richard Nixon, had served as an official observer in monitoring the Warren investigation and advising on the individual rights of various witnesses. So it's interesting that not only a close friend of Richard Nixon, but also a person who had worked with the Warren Commission, was selected by Rosemary Woods to be her defense attorney. Interestingly enough, she did that on November 22nd, 1973, 10 years to the day after John Kennedy's assassination. Now, as I mentioned, Nixon Treasury Secretary John Connally, who had been governor of Texas and was wounded in the motorcade with President Kennedy. John Connally also, incidentally, had been involved with recruiting Teamsters elements, allied with Jimmy Hoffa, to oppose President Kennedy's drive for the nomination, or just then Senator John Kennedy's drive for the Democratic nomination in 1960, and this in an attempt by John Connally to obtain the nomination for Lyndon Johnson. Of course, Lyndon Johnson later succeeded John Kennedy to the White House after Kennedy was assassinated, and it was John Connally, interestingly, who was working with Jimmy Hoffa, the Teamsters closely aligned with Richard Nixon, to oppose John Kennedy. Hoffa then later campaigned ardently for Nixon against Kennedy, and once again, LBJ did succeed Kennedy, of course, to become president, and it was John Connally, again later convicted initially in the Milk Fund scandal, part of the morass of wrongdoing that arose out of Watergate. It was John Connally who refused to extradite Sergio Arcacha Smith to New Orleans to stand trial in Jim Garrison's investigation. About Sergio Arcacha Smith and his connections to David Ferry, one of the initial suspects pursued by Jim Garrison, Fensterwald writes as follows. Sergio Arcacha Smith was the New Orleans director of the Cuban Democratic Revolutionary Front, also known as the FRD, or Frente Revolucionario Democratico, one of the key Cuban exile groups coordinated by the CIA for the Bay of Pigs invasion. E. Howard Hunt has written of his close involvement with the FRD and its key role in the ill-fated CIA operation. Sergio Arcacha Smith, long regarded as one of the more conspiratorial Cuban exile leaders, was also a key official in two of the other CIA-sponsored Cuban exile organizations, the Crusade to Free Cuba Committee and the largest of the CIA exile groups, the Cuban Revolutionary Council. CIA officials have long admitted the agency's involvement in coordinating both of these exile groups. Harold Weisberg has cited various Secret Service reports that set forth Sergio Arcacha Smith's involvement with these groups. Critic Weisberg has noted that a December 9, 1963 Secret Service report reveals that the Cuban Revolutionary Council, maintained an office in New Orleans at 544 Camp Street from October 1961 to February 1962. Another Secret Service report on other militant anti-Castro exiles notes that Smith was one of six Cuban exile officials authorized to sign checks for the CIA-sponsored Revolutionary Council, along with Luis Ravel, R-A-V-E-L, Manuel Gil, G-I-L, Ernesto Rodriguez Sr. and Jr., and Joaquin Villodas, V-I-L-L-O-D-A-S. Sergio Arcacha Smith provides the clearest example of David Ferry's links to militant Cuban exiles, the anti-Castro zealots who were employed by both the CIA and the Mafia. Smith's close association with Ferry, Carlos Marcello's private investigator and pilot, traced back to the Bay of Pigs when Smith and Ferry were both engaged in the activities of the FRD. In the summer of 1961, New Orleans FRD director Sergio Arcacha Smith wrote to Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, R-I-C-K-E-N-B-A-C-K-E-R, chairman of the board of Eastern Airlines, to request a leave of absence for Eastern pilot David Ferry. Smith told Rickenbacker in his letter of July 18, 1961, "When the FRD was originally organized under the demands of the U.S. government, the FRD was to front for the effort of the CIA to reinstate democratic government in Cuba. The effort of April 17th failed. As you know, thereafter, the morale of the Cubans in exile and the underground within Cuba fell to zero. Then along came Captain Ferry. he strongly prodded our whole organization until it was revitalized. Thereafter, dissident elements were removed, fund collecting began, the underground was reorganized, and the re-harassment of Castro has begun. The reinvigorating of our program was the result of the prodding of Captain Ferry and his associates here in New Orleans. Through him, we've been able to get the best advice in affairs political, economic, and military. In addition, Captain Ferry has been assisting in obtaining needed equipment. Since events are approaching a climax, we thoroughly need his advice on a day-to-day basis. We are requesting that Captain Ferry be given either a 60 or 90-day leave with pay so that the work at hand can be completed. At this time, he holds in his hands so many threads which pertain to the security of the Caribbean area that no reasonable substitution can be made, unquote. So obviously there were very strong connections between Sergio Arcacha Smith and the CIA and David Ferry's involvement with both. There was a CBS television, quote, documentary, unquote, Reid cover-up, in which various theories were presented by Dandy Dan Rather about the Kennedy assassination, and the last of the theories was the Mafia did it, and they had a fellow on, and he was basically talking about how there was absolutely no indication that the CIA had been involved whatsoever in the Kennedy assassination. He then went on to say the Mafia did it, there's no evidence of CIA involvement, and the proof of that was that David Ferry worked for Carlos Marcello. Well, David Ferry also worked with the CIA and its anti-Castro effort, as indicated in that literature. There's abundant evidence that David Ferry was deeply involved with not only the CIA, but specifically its anti-Castro efforts over a period of years. By the way, the individual involved in that was Jonathan Quitney, who has done some good work, but he obviously missed the boat rather fundamentally on the subject of the Kennedy assassination. Now, bear in mind that Sergio Arcacha Smith had rented the 544 Camp Street address used by Oswald for the CRC, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the umbrella group coordinating all of the CIA's anti-Castro Cuban groups. Of the CRC and its reorganization, or its organization, Fensterwall writes, the key CIA-coordinated exile group, the Cuban Revolutionary Council, had been personally coordinated by Hunt and Barker, that is, E. Howard Hunt and Bernard Barker, both of them key Watergate burglars. Proceeding. Several Cuban exiles whose names have surfaced in regard to the Kennedy assassination were at one time or another involved with the council. Interestingly, Lee Harvey Oswald had once given the address of a building used by the New Orleans branch of the Cuban Revolutionary Council as his own address. Oswald had stamped this Camp Street address on his own pro-Castro leaflets, an action which the Warren Commission admitted couldn't be explained. Still another member of the anti-Castro Cuban community involved with the various efforts on behalf of CIA, who was connected to Watergate and perhaps to the Kennedy assassination, was a fellow named Manuel Artime, A-R-T-I-M-E. Fensterwall writes about him, saying, Manuel Artime, the well-known Bay of Pigs exile leader, had been E. Howard Hunt's closest friend for over a decade. Artime had been the organizer of the early Cuban Defense Fund, which had been used to funnel secret hush money payments to the Watergate burglars before the Nixon inner circle took over the personal handling of the payoffs. Skipping down, the Senate Intelligence Committee established that Manuel Artime had earlier served as the key assassination conspirator in a CIA plot to assassinate Fidel Castro. Though the Senate committee used the CIA code name B1 in referring to Artime and also referred to him as, quote, the leader of an anti-Castro group, his identity was subsequently confirmed by Senate Intelligence Committee sources as well as the Washington Post. The Senate committee disclosed that Artime had been involved with another CIA assassin, codenamed AM/Lash, L-A-S-H, in plotting the assassination of Fidel Castro in 1963 and 1964. AM Lash has since been identified as former Cuban official Rolando Cubela by Senate committee members at C-U-B-E-L-A. The committee disclosed that, quote, the CIA put A.M. Lash Cubela in contact with B-1 Artime to set up another assassination plan against Castro. An internal CIA report noted that, quote, B-1 needed a man inside Havana, and A.M. Lash wanted a silenced weapon which CIA was unwilling to furnish him directly. By putting the two together, B-1 might get a man inside Cuba, and A.M. Lash might get his silenced weapon from B-1. A subsequent CIA document cited by the Senate committee stated that B-1 is to provide A.M. Lash with a silencer for the FAL rifle. If this is impossible, B-1 is to cache at a designated location a rifle with a scope and silencer, unquote. Later, Manuel Atime and Rolando Cubella did in fact exchange various assassination weapons. A CIA cable indicated that Cubella, A.M. Lash, would receive one pistol with silencer and one FAL rifle with silencer from B-1 Aratime's secretary. Another CIA cable indicated that, quote, B-1 had three packages of special items made up by his technical people and delivered to A.M. Lash, unquote. There has been a lot of speculation that perhaps many of the elements that had been used against Fidel Castro were later used against President Kennedy. That appears probable. Yet another person whose name crops up in connection with both Watergate and the Kennedy assassination investigation, albeit in a peripheral way to the latter, is Nixon aide and White House dirty trick specialist John Caulfield. That's spelled C-A-U-L-F-I-E-L-D. Now, Caulfield and his involvement with Nixon as a dirty trick specialist, and later, as we shall see, or actually it was earlier, but later in the text, his involvement with investigating the DRE, and the DRE had supposedly had connections with Lee Harvey Oswald. That was an anti-Castro group. And Fensterwald writes as follows about John Caulfield. John Caulfield served as a secret White House investigator for President Nixon, H.R. Haldeman, John Ehrlichman, and John Dean. Caulfield had previously served as a member of Vice President Richard Nixon's Secret Service detail in the 1950s. Caulfield and his partner Anthony Tony Ulasewicz became key witnesses before the Irvin Watergate Committee, which had astonished the nationwide viewing audience during their televised testimony about the dirty projects they had undertaken for the Nixon inner circle. Caulfield and Ulasewicz engaged in extensive surveillance and smear operations against leading Democratic senators and congressmen during their work for the Nixon men and focused their greatest attention on Senator Edward M. Kennedy. As the Senate Watergate Committee hearings established in 1971, Caulfield had been assigned to set up round-the-clock surveillance of Senator Kennedy, complete with a tailing of all the senator's movements. Another Caulfield assignment involved sending Ulasewicz to the island of Chappaquiddick hours after Kennedy's car plunged off the Dyke Bridge there. Ulasewicz began an immediate on-the-scene probe of the accident for the White House. Still later, according to the Irvin Committee, Caulfield and Ulasewicz had planned an extensive secret program to sexually entrap the various women who had been present at the Kennedy yachting party at Chappaquiddick. I would also add that there is substantive indication that the New York City's Bureau of Special Services, or BOSS, its anti-crime and anti-Red Squad, was involved in the assassination of Malcolm X. Both Caulfield and Ulasewicz were deeply involved with the Bureau of Special Services. And interestingly enough, that Bureau of Special Services was involved with investigating anti-Castro Cuban exiles in the New York area, and the Warren Commission contacted them at one point. Skipping down, in Fensterwald's account, an obscure FBI memorandum of May 28, 1964, titled, quote, Lee Harvey Oswald, Internal Security, R. Cuba, discloses that, quote, Detective John Caulfield, Bureau of Special Services, New York City Police Department, had investigated various anti-Castro Cuban exiles in New York during the course of the Warren Commission investigation. Caulfield had provided information on the DRE, the Cuban Student Directorate, which was an anti-Castro group with which Oswald had allegedly had some contact. Now, it's worth noting that the only contact Oswald ever had with DRE, as far as is known, was with a fellow named Carlos Bringier, as we looked at it in The Guns of November, Part 1. The DRE, the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil, was an anti-Castro group, and Carlos Bringier and Oswald got into a scuffle, and that led to a very well-known televised appearance by Lee Harvey Oswald and Carlos Bringier, set up by people connected with the intelligence community, including Ed Butler, that was in The Guns of November, Part 1. Interestingly, too, there appear to be connecting links between Richard Nixon and Watergate and the attempted assassination of George Wallace of Alabama. Now, George Wallace, who had been running for the Democratic nomination, was seriously considering the possibility of running as a third-party candidate. Now, Richard Nixon was basing his 1972 re-election hopes on the strategy that he called the Southern Strategy. Nixon was hoping to sweep the South and the Sun Belt, thereby counteracting traditional Democratic electoral strength in the industrial Midwest and Northeast, and had George Wallace run as a third-party candidate, and he was considering that, that might have threatened Nixon's Southern Strategy. Well, when Arthur Bremer shot and critically wounded Governor Wallace, that eliminated that possibility. It is not known exactly who shot George Wallace. It is a matter of public record for those who choose to examine it that it could not have been Arthur Bremer. Arthur Bremer was seized on the spot in Laurel, Maryland, after having supposedly shot George Wallace. He was then immediately taken off and tested and interrogated, and the paraffin tests performed on Arthur Bremer were negative. What that means is that he didn't shoot a gun, and interestingly, his, quote, defense attorney, unquote, never introduced that evidence at Bremer's trial. So whoever shot George Wallace, it wasn't Arthur Bremer, and the shooting of George Wallace eliminated a potential threat to Richard Nixon's re-election. Interestingly, Charles Colson, the same special counsel for Richard Nixon who was going to recruit Gordon Novell to study the possibility of erasing the Watergate tapes, or to erase them, he also was involved in a plan to break into the Milwaukee apartment of Arthur Bremer a few hours after Bremer shot Governor George Wallace of Alabama. Fensterwald writes about this. Charles Colson was also involved in a still mysterious plan to break into the Milwaukee apartment of Arthur Bremer a few hours after Bremer shot Governor George Wallace of Alabama. E. Howard Hunt testified that Colson had ordered him to fly to Milwaukee and break into Bremer's apartment, but that Colson subsequently canceled the orders following Hunt's objections. Colson, who denied Hunt's account, has stated that he merely discussed Bremer's psychological makeup during this conversation with Hunt. On January 5th, 1976, CBS News correspondent Dan Rather disclosed a previously classified Secret Service report which stated that Bremer's apartment had subsequently been sealed off by the FBI under the personal orders of President Nixon, orders that had been relayed through Colson, who refuses to comment on the matter. Washington Post reporters Woodward and Bernstein have written that Colson and his law partner David Shapiro seemed to hint that they would, quote, help out, unquote, the two reporters with other articles if they would, quote, kill, unquote, their original plans to publish the story of the Bremer break-in plans. According to the two reporters, Woodward told Colson and Shapiro that he had uncovered the mysterious Bremer plan during an interview with them on June 19, 1973. Colson and Shapiro then indicated that they might be able to provide Woodward with copies of two other Watergate documents, an offer that Woodward thought may have been contingent upon not publishing the Bremer disclosure. Woodward and Bernstein described the incident in All the President's Men. So one certainly has to ask some questions about not only the motive for Richard Nixon having the FBI seal off Bremer's apartment, but also why the proposed break-in into Bremer's apartment a few hours after Governor Wallace was shot. There had been widespread anxiety on the part of the Nixon re-election committee that people might connect Arthur Bremer and the attempt on Wallace's life to the appropriately named CREEP, the Committee to Re-elect the President. It's worth noting that when Richard Nixon was elected president the first time, that of course in 1968, his election was greatly aided by the fact that Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy's brother, did not wind up facing him in the 1968 election. That of course because Robert Kennedy was assassinated just after winning the California primary and virtually assuring himself of the Democratic nomination. Saran Saran, the individual who was convicted of assassinating Robert Kennedy, was not, in fact, the man who assassinated him. There is abundant evidence in that regard, and I refer people to to Radio Free America program number 9 for a lengthy discussion of that. But interestingly enough, although this is certainly by no means conclusive, the entry of the Saran family into the United States was affected by two college chums and political allies of Richard Nixon. In the book, The Assassination of Robert F. Kennedy by John Christian and William W. Turner, a former FBI agent turned private investigator and author, there is a discussion of this. This, by the way, was in Radio Free America number 9. Saran Saran had spent his early childhood in a Palestine torn by the Arab-Israeli conflict of 1948. His family belonged to a Lutheran congregation, but in 1956 switched to the Greek Orthodox Church and soon thereafter was able to migrate to America. Their immigration sponsors were a socially prominent Pasadena couple active in the Republican Party and, in time, the Nixon campaigns. The couple had known Richard Nixon at Whittier College. So again, not conclusive, but it's interesting that we find all of these connecting links of one sort or another. And some of these connections certainly could be coincidences. I'm not saying that they aren't. There are coincidences in life, and some of them might be, but I think one would have to be an idiot to assume they were all coincidences. I would note, too, that the individual most people have cited as the assassin of Robert Kennedy was a man named Thane Eugene Caesar, who worked in the Lockheed Burbank plant in a facility associated with the CIA's U-2 project. Oswald also had been associated with the U-2 project, although Oswald, of course, was not the assassin of President John Kennedy. And it had been Thane Eugene Caesar. Again, he worked in Lockheed by day, and he had been working as a guard for the ACE Security Service in the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles and was standing right behind Robert Kennedy where the fatal shots came from. Saran was standing well in front of Robert Kennedy. The director of security for Richard Nixon's campaign in 1968 was a guy named James Golden, G-O-L-D-E-N, who was working as director for Nixon's campaign, security director for Nixon's campaign, while on leave as director of corporate security for the Lockheed Corporation. Golden also had been part of Nixon's Secret Service detachment when he was a vice president, just like John Caulfield. So again, that is not conclusive, but it's really interesting to find Nixon's probable involvement in John Kennedy's assassination. He certainly lied in his teeth about what he was doing in Dallas, Texas, and when he left. And all of these massive, this massive body of connections between the John Kennedy assassination and Watergate, some of them relatively peripheral, some of them quite central, some of them coincidental, but they damn sure all aren't coincidental. We also find an unusual amount of interest by the Nixon White House in the investigation into the shooting of George Wallace, which eliminated Wallace as a possible third-party candidate. And we also find Nixon political supporters connected to the entry of the Saran family, Saran the patsy, I should say, for Robert Kennedy's assassination, which greatly benefited Richard Nixon. It's interesting to review this because as I sit here, and by the way, for those who eventually hear this program on tape, it is June 28th, 1992, almost 9 years since I first did Guns of November Part 3, to which this is going to be added. It's really interesting to observe Richard Nixon, our elder statesman. He continues to hold forth, his op-ed columns continue to appear in newspapers, and he really is viewed as something of a gray eminence. Well, he certainly has gotten away with an awful lot over the course of his political career. In all probability, at least one and possibly two political assassinations, and quite possibly a third attempt at assassination. And he can count himself a very lucky individual. Lucky perhaps because the American people are so incredibly stupid that they refuse to face the obvious facts of their own political history. But then that is the way it goes. And this concludes the addendum, and this will be added as an addendum to the Guns of November Part 3, originally done on November 15th, 1983, upon the 20th anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination. Yes, indeed, it does. And we are going to set into the archives for the record some more about Richard Nixon's political career. There was a very interesting op-ed column that appeared in the San Francisco Examiner of Friday, April 29th of 1994. This is by Janet Kornblum, K-O-R-N-B-L-U-M, and Rachel Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N. It's entitled, Nixon Forever a Scoundrel.
I'm just going to read the first few paragraphs. We both remember where we were when it happened. One of us gathered with family and neighbors in a Victorian flat in San Francisco, watching on a black and white television as a solemn Richard Nixon resigned the presidency of the United States. The grown-ups down Manhattan's in a strange mix of celebration and sorrow. 400 miles away at a Los Angeles summer camp, the other of us was whisked with her cabin mates to the mess hall, where all the children and counselors sat dumbfounded witnessing the same historic event. While our parents' generation asks the question, where were you when Kennedy was shot? We often ask each other, where were you when Nixon resigned? We all remember. Indeed, the two questions are linked in a manner that I suspect the Mrs. Kornblum and Rachel Gordon did not know at the time, or perhaps do not know to this date. The question about Richard Nixon's resignation and the reason he was obliged to resign, eventually enough of the, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote, did come out. And the question about where were you when John Kennedy was shot, they are, in fact, much more closely connected than one might be led to suspect. And as we have already seen, the connection of Richard Nixon to the assassination of John Kennedy, and in turn, the relationship between the milieu that was involved in John Kennedy's assassination and the milieu of Watergate, including Richard Nixon, remains a very open and a sensitive question. The connections are strong, and they're very, very significant. What we're going to do now, I think I'm going to reverse the order that I had stated originally that I was going to play some of this material in. What we're going to do next is we're going to listen to a section of Radio Free America program number 23. That's entitled The Terror Connection, Part 2, California under Ronald Reagan. What we're going to be hearing about is yet another aspect of the darker side of Watergate, what was going on vis-a-vis Richard Nixon's Dirty Tricks program, there was a great deal going on that never truly emerged. We are going to conclude our examination of Richard Nixon's political career by taking a look at what a freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger has termed the Miami Conspiracy, and in turn talking about the relationship of things like the John Kennedy assassination, the Bay of Pigs, Watergate, to a much larger political milieu, and indeed an international fascist milieu, which is the dominant political milieu in the world today. What we're going to do now, however, is we're going to listen to a section of Radio Free America program number 23. By the way, you just heard an addendum to the Guns of November Part 3, done originally in November of 1983, that addendum from June 28, 1972. What you're going to hear now is a segment of Radio Free America program number 23. This was originally recorded in August of 1986. Once again, in addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who very capably assisted me with the on-air responsibilities. What we're going to be hearing about is one of the dirtier tricks of the many dirty tricks that Richard Nixon was involved in. This one, fortunately, was not pulled off because one of the primary tricksters elected to go state's evidence. Material you're going to hear is from a book called The Glass House Tapes that was co-authored by Lewis Tackwood, T-A-C-K-W-O-O-D, and the Citizens Research and Investigating Committee, a group of investigative journalists that were instrumental in breaking the story of the Squad 19 conspiracy. The Criminal Conspiracy Section, or CCS, that you're going to be hearing about was an intelligence unit of the Los Angeles Police Department, which functioned basically as a private intelligence service. It worked with the CIA and the FBI. It operated not only in the city of Los Angeles, but all over the state of California and even outside of the state of California. This despite the fact that it was actually a unit of the LAPD and as such only entitled to operate in Los Angeles proper. That didn't stop it, and one of the specialties of the Criminal Conspiracy Section was the setting up of provocations, incidents to be blamed on the opposition in order to discredit them and to justify a predetermined response. And indeed, the Squad 19 conspiracy appears to have been not only a provocation or a potential provocation, but a very, very nasty one at that.